White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to the Thanksgiving Day edition of the International Jews Study Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager with co-host Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Did you have a nice day today, Hadding?
It was peaceful.
That's good. Yes, so is mine. That's what Thanksgiving is supposed to be. So, well, we've got some listeners, even though it's Thanksgiving night, and I guess there's all kinds of big football games on, but Carl said he was going to be listening. Because he doesn't like football, so we know he's there. well, folks, we got about two-thirds of the way through Chapter 17 last week. And this tonight we will complete this chapter, which is a good chapter, about the press. And we will begin Chapter 18, and we might be able to finish Chapter 18. I kind of hope so. It's sort of an extension of Chapter 17. It's asking, does the control of the press explain Jewish political power? Or I'm not sure if the question is, do the protocols explain Jewish political power? We'll see when we get there. Now, I'm going to give you a short summary of last week, very short, just so we don't, you know, because we're just going to start in the middle of the two-thirds of the way through the chapter. So it starts out with the Jews' appreciation and handling of news, and relating the well-known story of Nathan Rothschild following Napoleon's army, he followed Napoleon's army to know before anyone else the outcome of the particularly crucial battle.
Well, he followed the Wellington's army.
Wellington's army, thank you. Wellington's army, yes. Okay, the British army, he followed them, who were fighting Napoleon, right? And he wanted to find out who won before anyone else. And when he did find out that it was Wellington, he rushed. See, the news was very slow then, so he rushed back to London to make a fortune in the stock exchange by getting all the other people to sell their English securities, because he acted like he knew that Wellington had lost. And while they were selling, he had agents buying them all up, profiting £10 million. And you know, the point is that they news is very important to the Jews, and they go after it and they use it for themselves and don't help other people out with it, only each other. And the chapter goes on to note that the protocols propose very definite plans with regard to the press. They recommend publishing demoralizing doctrines and news that will inflame the passions of partisanship. They say the press is already in our hands. They say literature and journalism are the two most important educational forces, and they will own most of the journals. Well, this is true. They do today. Now, they say they prefer cheap and widely read articles, journals, and books over long and better ones, better quality ones, which few people read. They like people read the cheap and short ones, and they will form opposition journals to attack and other things, you know, papers and magazine books and so on, to attack themselves, so that they want to be on all sides of the issue, as we say,
false opposition.
Yeah, false opposition, in order that those who oppose them will join into this opposition and then show the Jews their cards or reveal their plans. So they think they have everything figured out. And that's what they're discussing in this in this chapter so far. So our reader here, Hadding, is going to start with the paragraph right before we stopped last week, right? And this happens to be a protocol being read.
Yeah.
And that means I do that. So
that's right.
Okay, here we start. Continuing with chapter 17. by always discussing and contradicting our writings superficially. By always discussing and contradicting our writings superficially and without touching upon their essence, our press will keep up a blank fire against the official newspapers only to give us opportunity to express ourselves in greater detail than we could in our first declaration. This will be done when useful to us. These attacks will also convince the people of the full freedom of the press, and it will give our agents the opportunity of declaring that the papers opposing us are mere windbags, since they cannot find any real arguments to oppose our orders. Well, you know, here I've already got a comment, but I don't have too many tonight. But my comment here is that this is like the tabloid type papers, you know, that irritate me so. And I don't mean the ones at the grocery store. I mean the ones you see. Well, I see them online, you know, but they're tabloid type. They're regular newspapers, but they're full of sex and shocking, tasteless headlines and photos. And this gives, I think, an impression that we have free speech and free press and you can write about anything. But on the other hand, certain political and social subjects are verboten, and we're not free to speak about them at all. So that's my comment, Hattie.
Well, it reminds me of the fake patriot media, people like William Cooper and Alex Jones, that they seem to get a lot of support from Jewish sources.
Yeah, they probably do. They probably did. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No doubt Cooper did. He was genuinely a little bit off his rocker, apparently. But
I don't know him. William Cooper, huh?
William Cooper. Yeah, Alex Jones basically stole William Cooper's act.
Okay. That was before I knew about any of this.
Yeah. Okay. Undoubtedly, that would be the case were all the papers controlled. In the case of the present series of articles, however, the tables appear to be turned. It is the Jewish press which has so signally failed to bring forward disproof, either by fact or argument.
When necessary, we shall promulgate ideas in the third section of our press as feelers and then refute them vigorously in the semi-official press. We shall overcome our opponents without fail because they will not have organs of the press at their disposal. The pretext for suppressing, well, that's the way we are now, right? That's absolutely. Okay, the pretext for suppressing a publication will be that it stirs up the public mind without basis of reason.
A pretext which has already been urged time and again, but without the legal power to effect suppression, although without legal power, the Jewish interests in the United States have effected a pretty complete suppression of everything they do not desire. How far does Jewish influence control the newspapers of the United States? Insofar as the use of the word Jew is concerned, the press is almost completely dominated. The editor who uses it is certain to hear from it. He will be visited and told, contrary to everything the Jew is told, that the word Jew denotes a member of a religious denomination and not a member of a race, and that its use with reference to any person spoken of in the public prints is as reprehensible as if Baptist, Catholic, or Episcopalian were used. The Jew is always told by his leaders that regardless of religion or country of birth, he is a Jew, the member of a race by virtue of blood. Pages of this paper could be filled with the most authoritative Jewish statements on this point. But what the Jew is told by his leaders and what the Gentile editor is told by the Jewish committee are two different and antagonistic things. A Jewish paper may shriek to the skies that Professor so-and-so or Judge so-and-so or Senator so-and-so is a Jew. But the secular newspaper that should do that would be visited by an indignant committee bearing threats. A certain newspaper, as a mere matter of news, published an excerpt from one of the Dearborn Independent articles. Next day, a number of advertising accounts dropped for lack of copy. Inquiry developed the fact that the reticent advertisers were all Jewish firms, and the cause of their action was the really unimportant excerpt which the paper published. It developed also that the advertising agent who handled all the advertising for those Jewish firms was himself a Jew, who also held an office in a Jewish secret society, which office was concerned exclusively with the control of newspapers in the matter of Jewish publicity. Probably means any defamation league of B'nai B'rith. It was this man who dealt with the editor. A lame editorial retraction followed, which faintly praised the Jews. The advertising was returned to the paper, and it is a just question whether that editor was rightly handled or not. Certainly he has been made to feel the power, but the diplomacy of it was bad. The editor, along with hundreds of others, had only been given the proper background for estimating the Jewish power in its wider reaches. This is not to say that every editor should enter upon a campaign to expose the secret power. That is a matter of personal decision, for personal decision. Every editor, however, is so situated that he can see certain things, and he ought to see them, note them, and inwardly digest them. Jewish publicity in response to these articles is very easy to get in almost any newspaper.
Yeah, it was this, when they say these articles, they mean what's in the Dearborn Independent. Right?
Yeah. Some have fallen most lamentably for lying statements. Others have opened their columns to propaganda sent out from Jewish sources. That is all very well. But the Gentile interest in the question has been largely ignored, even in cases where the editors are awake to the whole question. This, too, affords a vantage from which the average editor can view what is transpiring in this country.
Well, I just have to say here that when they say some have fallen most lamentably for lying statements, I like that because right now I'm writing and trying to get some attention from the Associated Press about Verena Dobnik's statements that I think she's lying about. And, you know, so here's another example today about Elie Wiesel showing her his tattoo, which I'm sure he doesn't have one. So, you know, she's got to be lying about it. But I'm all for if he, you know, I'm all for him showing it if he's got one. I don't mind if I'm wrong. But, you know, you can't get that to happen. So I don't think I am wrong. But here you have where everybody just keeps falling for these lying statements that are in these newspapers. Okay, that's it.
If a list of the Jewish owners, bondholders, and other interests in our newspapers should be published, the list would be impressive. But it would not account for the widespread control of the press as observed in this country. Indeed, it would be unfair in such a connection as this to list some of the Jewish-owned newspapers of the United States, because their owners are fair and public-spirited servants of the people.
Well, I say that's wrong, turns out, but they hoped that they thought that was true at the time.
Yeah.
And can you think any Jewish-owned newspaper in the United States is fair and public-spirited?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Actually, you know,
public-spirited for the Jewish community. Mm. That's all I can see.
Actually, a lot of the stuff in the actual news reporting in the New York Times is actually pretty good most of the time, although they kind of made Judith Miller a scapegoat for their bad reporting on the Iraq situation.
Well, you're right. That. The New York Times is the status newspaper of the entire United States, and it's classy. And it's got a whole lot of good stuff in it, a lot of good reporting. I mean, a lot of good articles, all kinds of things. But as far as their news and stuff, it is all geared to benefit what the Jews want. That's true. But otherwise, you know, yeah.
Well, they have a lot of non-Jews on their staff, though, that do some good work.
Yeah, that's true. That's what I mean. They have a standard to hold up to, which they know they have to hold to if they're going to remain whatever they're called, the newspaper of record or something. So they have to do that, but they still cater to the Jews.
Yeah.
Very, very, very much.
Yeah. In the case of Judith Miller's reporting on Iraq, I wrote about that at the time. I was making fun of her reports from Iraq because they were so transparently faulty, just if you read them carefully, that the editors had to know, but they didn't come out and say, oh, this is, you know, they didn't come out and say how bad it was until they got exposed, sort of.
Right. Right.
You know, they had to have their feet put to the fire. Then they blamed it on her. But actually, the editors should have known better.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying about this little incident with Elie Wiesel and this Verena Dobnik. But, you know, you didn't get any credit for what you were pointing out at the time before anybody else, maybe. We never get credit.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that I didn't influence the situation, though.
Well, I hope so.
Actual ownership does not often account for much in a newspaper. Ownership in the newspaper business is not always synonymous with control. If you wish to know the control of the newspaper, look to its attorney and the interests he serves. Look to the social connections of its chief editors. Look to the advertising agents who handle the bulk of Jewish advertising. And then look to the matter of the paper's partisanship or independence in politics. Newspaper control of the press by the Jews is not a matter of money. It is a matter of keeping certain things out of the public mind and putting certain things into it.
Well, now I just have to interject here. I don't know how well this fits, but you have said, Hadding, that the Jews are mainly after just making a bunch of money. And
no.
Okay, all right. Well, I thought you would say no to that, because you know they are also interested in presenting things in their way and hiding things they don't want to be known.
There are certain behaviors of theirs, certain noxious behaviors of theirs that can be explained as just trying to make more money, rather than as a deliberate, malevolence. But I would never say that everything destructive that they do is explainable that way.
Okay, very well said.
All right.
Well said.
One absolute condition insisted upon with the daily press is that it shall not identify the Jew, mention him, or in any but the most favorable way call the public's attention to his existence. The first plea for this is based on fairness, on the false statement that a Jew is not a Jew but a church member.
Oh, I just love that. I just love that. It makes me laugh.
This is the same statement which Jewish agents in the United States government have used for years to prevent the United States government from listing Jews in any racial statistics. It is in direct contradiction to what the Jews themselves are told. A flabby fairness, a sloppy broad-mindedness, a cry of religious prejudice is the first plea. The second is a sudden cessation of Jewish patronage. The third is withdrawal of patronage by every Gentile concern that is under the grip of Jewish financiers. It is a mere matter of brutal bludgeoning. And the fourth act in a community thoroughly blinded to the Jewish question is the collapse of the offending publication.
Like poor old Dearborn Independent. Eventually. Okay.
Read the Jewish Encyclopedia for a list of some of the papers which dared open up the question and ceased. When old Baron Moses Montefiore said at Krakow, "What are you prating about? As long as we do not have the press of the whole world in our hands, everything you may do is vain. We must control or influence the papers of the whole world in order to blind and deceive the people."
Now, there you go. He actually said that, I guess,
He knew what he was saying. Yeah. Well, I wonder what the source is for that statement.
Well, I don't know. I'd like to find out. But, I mean, we have all kinds of statements like that by these Jews. These top Moses Montefiore, he was a big one. Go ahead.
Wasn't able to document the other statement that was attributed to him earlier either. So I don't know.
Well, okay, we'll try to look for this and mention it next week.
By blinding the people, he only meant that they should not see the Jew, and by deceiving them, he only meant that the people should think certain world movements meant one thing when they really meant another. The people may be told what happens. They may not be told what was behind it. The people do not yet know why certain occurrences which have affected their whole lives should have occurred at all. But the why of it is very definitely known in certain circles whose news service never sees print, and sometimes not even writing. Statistics as to the space given the Jews by newspapers concerning the things they want to get into print would also be an eye-opener. A minority nation, they get more publicity than any 10 of the important minor nations of Europe. Of the kind of publicity they want.
That's so true. So true, isn't it? That almost should be read about 10 times. But
okay,
people can
get started.
It.
The number of Jewish contributors to the press of the United States makes another interesting statistical bit. It would be sheer prejudice to make objectionable mention of many Jewish journalists and writers, and they come within the scope of this study only as they have shown themselves to be the watchful agents and active servants of the system. This is what many of them are. Not the ambitious young Jewish reporter who runs around the streets gathering news, perhaps, but the journalist at the seat of news and at the necks of those two or three important international runways through which the news of the world flows. The whole matter, as far as extent of control is concerned, could be visualized on a map of the United States by means of colored pins showing the number of Jewish-owned, provably Jewish-controlled newspapers and the number of Jewish writers who are directing the majority thought of the various sections of the country.
That would be interesting. That would be interesting to see.
The Jewish journalist who panders to unrest, whose literary ambition is to maintain a ferment in his readers, whose humor is sordid, and whose philosophy is one of negation, as well as the Jewish novelist who extols his or her own people even while the story sows subtle seeds of disruption in Gentile social or economic life, must be listed as the agents of that world program which would break down society through the agency of ideas. And it is very striking how many there are and how skillfully they conceal their propaganda in their work.
Good point.
And I would say here that, you know, he talks about the world program, which means that it's all a big explicit plan that's been put down. Another explanation is it's just Jews being Jews.
Well, when they use the words, when they use the term world program, they're referring to the protocols.
Yes.
They're referring here the whole time here. They're still dealing with, and we're going to see that in the next chapter. It's all going to be pulled together. They're trying to put in all, from chapter one, they're building up this idea that the protocols give us this world program of the Jews. And you know, and whether we should accept it or not, whether we should accept that that's true or not. So that's what it's all about.
Yeah, well, if you have evolutionary psychology, then this kind of explanation becomes less important.
But it might be true. Not whether it's less important or not, it's whether it's true or not.
Well, it's not true.
Okay.
Here and there in the United States, it is now becoming possible to print the word Jew in the headlines of an article and tell the Jewish committee, which calls the next day, that this is as yet a free country. Quietly, a number of newspapers have tested the strength of this assumed control in their communities and have discounted it. There is no reason for fear on the part of the editor who has his facts. But the editor who backs down will more and more feel the pressure upon him. The man who courageously and fairly holds his ground will soon learn another thing that is not so generally known, namely that with all the brilliance there is a lot of bluff, and that the chain of control once broken is felt throughout the whole system as a blow. What you can infer from that there is that when Ford backed down in 1927, it was because he didn't have his facts.
Well, you can't infer that.
Sure you can.
No, you can't, because when they wrote this, that was a long way away. So I don't, you know, that's I don't think, you know, I'm surprised you said that. They're saying that the person who courageously and fairly holds his ground will find that, you know, that that is a better practice than backing down. And because there's a lot of bluff. Well, Ford did not back down for a long, long time. But finally, the details of all that have to be discussed to see whether he did what he did because he didn't have the facts. It was nothing about the facts. It was about him having to go through this trial, another trial, and have to take the stand and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And, okay.
There is nothing that the international Jew fears so much as the truth, or any hint of the truth about himself or his plans. And, after all, the rock of refuge and defense, the foundation of endurance for Jew or Gentile, must be the truth.
Well, do you disagree with that? Fear the truth?
If they
fear the truth, then how can they be doing anything, you know, right? I mean, right?
Me to answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, for us as white people, especially Northern Europeans, we have to be concerned with the truth because that's our nature. We are fixated on objective reality. And I constantly have to tell people, I don't have to tell them, but I feel it is incumbent upon me to tell them that their notion that we should copy the Jews and be crooked by the way they are is wrong, and it's not going to work for us.
Well, it's not. We can't. I'm not prepared to answer that right now, but I don't think that. I think that there's many ways that the Jews function that we need to understand, and we need to do it back to them. Yeah, and I don't think it's that we can't do it. And I think making ourselves out to be so wonderful and all just, you know, like some kind of gods, Nordic gods or something, you only know the truth. That's just not true in the first place. And we can do a lot of things, and we need to do them. We need to be tougher, I think. So I have a different outlook on that. And I think that would be the truth. I mean, that wouldn't be going against the truth, because the Jews are absolutely the ones who violate the truth. But they don't care, and they make their own truth. Well, this is the end of this chapter. I thought it was pretty darn good. And now we're going to get into these very questions quite a lot in this next chapter. And this is what's going to be interesting because, you know, does this explain Jewish political power? And as I said, I'm not sure if we should, or it could be both maybe. Does the power of the press explain it, or is it do the protocols explain it? And I think they mean that it's explained, that it's the protocols, but maybe it wouldn't be worded quite that way. But I do want to make the comment before we start that, as probably most people are aware, the other day, both of our houses of Congress in the United States, both of them voted unanimously on the same day for a resolution, I guess it was a resolution, that Israel has a right to defend itself in this current war. Or was it that they were on the side of Israel? It was something that sounded very extreme and unbelievable. You know, unanimously that the United States backs, that they back, or the United States should back Israel in this current situation, which tells us that, you know, Jews have total political power in the United States. Would you doubt that Jews have total political power in the United States as of now?
Well, total is an extreme term. AIPAC is certainly extremely influential.
Unanimous is an extreme term, too. How could both houses of Congress vote unanimously? You've got Republicans and Democrats, supposed to be different. But, you know, I think that, and look what's happening to Palestine and all the history of what they've done to Palestine, and yet these members of Congress, every darn one of them, is going to stand up and defend Israel, that they're in the right and the Palestinians need to quit shooting rockets or something.
Well, the real power is in the mass media. These politicians quake in their boots at the thought of getting bad press.
But what? Well, okay. Yeah, it's true. But still, they are, you know, that means they're the politicians and they're the ones who can vote for all this stuff. They have more important things than this resolution. And they're totally under the sway of the Jews. They are. So that's a huge amount of power. The United States is supposed to be the most powerful country in the world, and we can't stand up to this, to these 2% of Jews we have in our country. Now, you know, you can't talk your way out of that. That's extreme Jewish power that we have. So if you want to say something more, go ahead, but we'll start with chapter 18 if you want to start reading it.
Okay.
Okay. Have you got it there?
Yeah. I was just going to look into that thing a little bit, but I don't have time. Okay, chapter 18. Does this explain Jewish political power? Little has been said in this commentary on the protocols about the political program contained in them. It is desirable that the points be taken separately in order that when our study turns to actual conditions in this country, the reader may be in a position to judge whether the written program agrees with the acted program as it may be seen all about us. The world program, as outlined in these strange documents, turns upon many points, some of which have already been discussed. Its success is sought, A, by securing financial control of the world, this having already been secured by the overwhelming indebtedness of every nation through wars, and by the capitalistic, not the manufacturing or managerial, control of industry. Capitalistic theory means finance.
Mm-hmm. Good.
B, by securing political control, which is easily illustrated by the conditions of every civilized country today. C, by securing control of education, a control which has been steadily won under the blinded eyes of the people. D, trivializing the public mind through a most complete system of allurement which has just brought us into a period which requires the new word jazz to describe it. And E, by the sowing of seeds of disruption everywhere, not the seeds of progress but of economic fallacies and revolutionary temper. All of these main objectives entail various avenues of action, none of which has been overlooked by the protocols. In leading up to what the protocols have to say about the selection and control of presidents, it will be enlightening to take the views which these documents express about other phases of politics. It may be very interesting to those Jewish apologists who in all their pronouncements never discuss the contents of the protocols, to know that so far from there being a plea for monarchy, they are a plea for the most drastic and irresponsible liberalism in government. The powers behind the protocols appear to have absolute confidence in what they can do with the people once the people are made to believe that popular government has really arrived. The protocols believe in frequent change. They like elections. They approve frequent revisions of constitutions. They counsel the people to change their representatives often. Take this from the first protocol, Shmuley.
The abstract conception of liberty made it possible for us to convince the crowd that government is only the management for the owner of the country, the people, and that the steward can be changed like a pair of worn-out gloves. Yeah, it's like he's just a manager. All right. The possibility of changing the representatives of the people has placed them at our disposal, and as it were, has placed them in our power as creatures of our purposes.
Note also how this use of change is buried in this paragraph from the fourth protocol, which describes the evolution of a republic.
Every republic passes through several stages. The first is that of senseless ravings, resembling those of a blind man throwing himself from right to left. The second is that of demagogy, which breeds anarchy and inevitably leads to despotism, not of a legal, open, and consequently responsible character, but an unseen and unknown despotism, felt nonetheless because exercised by a secret organization. Such a despotism acts with even less scruple because it is hidden under cover and works behind the backs of various agents, the shifting and changing of which will not harm its secret power, but serve it, since such changes will relieve the organization from the necessity of expending its resources on rewards for long service.
This changing of servants is not unknown in the United States. A former senator of the United States could easily testify to this if he only knew who did the changing. Time was when he was the tool of every Jewish lobbyist in the Senate. His glib tongue lent charm and plausibility to every argument they wished to advance against the government's intentions. Secretly, however, the senator was receiving favors from a very high source, favors of a financial character. The time came when it was desirable to detach the senator. The written record of his favors was abstracted from its place of supposed secrecy, a newspaper system that has always been the ready organ of American Jewry made the exposure, and an indignant public did the rest. It could not have been done had not the man been compromised first. It could not have been done without certain newspaper connivance. It would never have been done had not the senator's masters wished it. However, it was done.
You know, isn't that the senator that they're referring to in a previous chapter? We said he said, "Well, we'll talk about that later," or something like that.
We'll save
that for another time. This might be the one.
Maybe he'll say more about it later. In the 14th protocol, which begins, "When we become rulers," it is pictured how hopeless the Gentile peoples will have become of any betterment of conditions through changes of government, and therefore will accept the promise of stability which the protocols of that time will be prepared to offer.
The masses will become so satiated with the endless changes of administration which we instigated among the Gentiles when we were undermining their governmental institutions that they will tolerate anything from us. Well, they do that in Europe more, right? Wasn't that more European? The European experience. And this is probably what they're still talking about. Europe.
Well, you know, we have changed every 4 years. That's pretty often.
Well, but that also prevents anybody from staying in there too long, you know, so.
Some people want to have term limits, which is just. That's just going to make things worse. Anytime you
really,
yeah, because anytime you take, the longer those politicians are in their office, the more power they get, the more they know what they're doing. The more you have the legislature filled with people that don't know what they're doing, the more pliable they're going to be. And what that will do is cause the center of power to shift away from the legislature to some other body. They'll be more influenced by mass media, more influenced by any kind of external pressure. This is something that's been known since ancient times. They did that. They made that mistake in classical Athens. They made the magistrates. They had a committee of 10 men that was supposed to rule Athens, and they made it so that they were chosen by lot, which would be the most democratic way possible to do it, so that somebody that had money wouldn't have an advantage over anybody else. All that did was cause the center of power in Athens to shift from the elected officials, or the officials chosen by lot. It shifted the power away from them to the generals. So basically the generals ruled Athens from then on. That's what happens when you have a high turnover rate in a legislature or in a government. It shifts the power to some other institution, like the mass media. Or if we had a strong church in this country, power could shift to the church.
So then they know what they're doing when they're wanting to change the officials all the time, because they run the media.
It makes the government more pliable.
Yeah, so that fits. You know that this is what they would want. Okay.
The official who has changed most quickly in this country is the man who questions certain matters which come from Jewish sources. There must be a small army of such men in the United States today. Some of them do not know even now how it happened. Some of them are still wondering why perfectly legitimate and patriotic information should have been lost in an icy silence when they sent it in, and why they should have lost favor for sending it. Protocol 9 is full of the most amazing claims, of which these may serve as an illustration.
At the present time, if any government raises a protest against us, it is only for the sake of form. It is under our control, and it is done by our direction, for their anti-Semitism is necessary for keeping in order our lesser brothers. I will not explain this further, as already it has been the subject of numerous discussions between us.
Yeah, that's very true there. The Jews don't mind somebody that just rails against the Jews as long as he doesn't make too much sense when he's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't. I think they love nothing better than a really mindless Jew baiter.
Well, what Jew baiters are really mindless? Now, come on.
There have been some.
Yeah, but most are not mindless. Most are right on target, and they use that too. So you can't say that anti-Semites are mindless, Hattie.
I can say that some of them are lowbrow.
Well, okay. There's lots of lowbrow people in the world, much more than there is highbrow.
They're talking, you know.
Well, and they go all different directions. They're on all different sides.
You know, some of them advocate crazy stuff at the same time that they're criticizing the Jews. That doesn't help.
Well, no, that people that don't know what they're doing don't ever help.
What the Jews hate most is a revisionist that doesn't seem to have anything against Jews. That drives them absolutely berserk, like Ernst Zindel. They hated Ernst Zindel more.
I don't know if that's the reason.
I'd say
I don't
so.
Think that's the reason. But anyway, that's a different discussion. So,
this doctrine of the usefulness of anti-Semitism and the desirability of creating it where it does not exist are found in the words of Jewish leaders, ancient and modern.
In reality, there are no obstacles before us. Our supergovernment has such an extra legal status that it may be called by the energetic and strong word dictatorship. I can conscientiously say that at the present time, we are the lawmakers.
In that protocol, this claim is made.
De facto, we have already eliminated every government except our own, although de jure, there are still many others left.
Okay. I have a problem with that statement there. That it says that the Jews have already eliminated every government except their own. That is clearly not true in 1903. And a Russian especially would know that it was not true in 1903 because the Tsar's government was not controlled by Jews. Jews probably would be very aware of it since they had a big grudge against the Tsar at the time. So this sentence here does not appear to have been written by a Russian or a Jew.
Okay, I'm going to look into that. I got that marked.
That is simple. The governments still exist under their own names, having authority over their own people. But the super government has unchallenged influence over all of them in matters pertaining to the Jewish nation, and particularly in matters pertaining to the purpose of the international Jew. The Eighth Protocol shows how this can be.
for the time being, until it will be safe to give responsible government positions to our brother Jews, we shall entrust them to people whose past and whose character are such that there is an abyss between them and the people, to people for whom, in case of disobedience to our orders, there will remain only trial or exile from public life, thus forcing them to protect our interests to their last breath.
In the Ninth Protocol, again, is this reference to party funds.
The division into parties has placed them all at our disposal, inasmuch as in order to carry on a party struggle, it is necessary to have money, and we have it all.
There have been many investigations of campaign funds. None has ever yet gone deep enough to inquire into the international source of these funds. Now, in the United States during the past 5 years, we have seen an almost complete Judaized administration in control of all the war activities of the American people. The function of the regularly organized United States government during that time was practically confined to the voting of money. But the administration of the business end of the war was in charge of a government within a government. And this inner extra government was Jewish.
Well, that's pretty important.
It is, of course, often asked why this was so. The first answer given is that the Jews who were immediately placed in charge of the business administration of the war were competent men, the most competent men who could be found. This was actually the answer given to an inquiry as to the reason for so large a part of the foreign policy of the United States depending on the counsel of a certain group of Jews. They were the men who knew. No one else knew so much. The officials chosen by the people had a right to select the most efficient and able counsel they could find. Very well, let that stand. Let the explanation be that in all the United States, Jews were the only persons to be found who could handle the emergency with masterly ease. We shall see more of this phase of the matter at another time. The war is not under discussion in this article, merely the fact that in an emergency the government became distinctively Jewish. But the second protocol would appear to throw a little light on the matter.
The administrators chosen by us from the masses for their servility will not be persons trained for government, and consequently they will easily become pawns in our game, played by our learned and talented counselors, specialists educated from early childhood to administer world affairs. As we know, our specialists have been acquiring the necessary knowledge for governing.
The language is a trifle raw, as it usually is when Gentiles are under discussion. But the same fact, namely that Jewish specialists have come to the aid of Gentile administrators in an emergency, when uttered for the consideration of the general public, may be very beautifully phrased. The untrained Gentile administrator must have help. His unpreparedness makes it necessary. And who knows it better than those who have the help to offer? The Gentile public has been taught to suspect the man who has had experience in politics or government. This, of course, makes the whole situation doubly easy for those whose specialty it is to give aid. Just what interests they aid most will give, when discovered, a strong light upon their zeal. But in all that the protocols have to say about the political angle of the world program, nothing is of so great interest as that which concerns the selection and control of presidents. The whole plan is outlined in the 10th protocol. The fact that the president of France seems to have been in mind is a localism. The plan is applicable elsewhere, indeed has elsewhere its most perfect illustration. That would be a hint right there about the derivation of parts of this from Maurice Joly. This 10th protocol then leads gradually up to the subject. tracing the evolution of rulers from autocrat to president, and of nations from monarchies to republics. The language of this passage is particularly objectionable, but no more so than can be found in current Jewish literature, where boasting of power is indulged in. Unpleasant as the whole attitude is, it is valuable as showing in just what light the supporters of the protocol program view the Gentiles and their dignities. It must be borne in mind that the Jewish ideal is not a president, but a prince and a king. The Jewish students of Russia marched the streets in 1918 singing this hymn, we have given you a god, now we will give you a king. The new flag of Palestine, now permitted to fly without hindrance, bears insignia, as does every synagogue, of a Jewish king. Now, I just want to point out that the Star of David has also been known as the Star of Remphan and the Star of Moloch, and I think those names are actually older.
Okay, interesting.
It's also called the Star of Saturn, but anyway.
Well, I'll have to look that up.
Peter Schenk used to like to talk about that.
Peter Schenk.
The Jewish hope is that the throne of David shall be set up again, as doubtless it will be. None of these things is to be decried in the least, nor to be regarded with anything but a decent respect, but they should be borne in mind as a sidelight on the expressed contempt for Gentile presidents and legislatures. The 10th protocol reaches the theme of president thus.
Then the rise of the Republican era became possible, and then in the place of a sovereign, we substituted a caricature of him, a president picked from the crowd. Such was the foundation of the mine we laid underneath the Gentile people, or more accurately, the Gentile peoples.
It is with something of a shock that one reads that men with a past are specially favored for the presidential office. Men with a past have become president in various countries, including the United States, there is no doubt of that. In some instances, the particular scandal that constituted the past has been publicly known. In other cases, it has been hushed up and lost in a maze of rumor. In at least one case, it was made the special property of a syndicate of men who, while protecting the official from public knowledge, compelled him to pay rather stiffly for their service. Men with a past are not uncommon, and it is not always the past, but the concealment of it that concerns them most. And in this lack of frankness, this distrust of the understanding and mercy of the people, they usually fall into another slavery, namely the slavery of political or financial blackmail.
We will manipulate the election of presidents whose past contains some undisclosed dark affair, some Panama. Then they will be faithful executors of our orders from fear of exposure and from the natural desire of every man who has attained a position of authority to retain the privileges, emoluments, and the dignity associated with the position of president. Yeah, well, aren't they saying that once people get used to all those benefits of high office, they don't want to give it up, and they will hang on even if they have to, you know, do favors for people, like for Jews. Yeah. Isn't that what it's saying?
They enjoy being the big wheel and.
Yeah, well, look at Obama. You know, look at all that he can do. He can do any damn thing he wants, and they go on these expensive trips and stay in luxury places and so on, and you know, God, and they have all this security around them and everybody to do their bidding, and oh my God, really, it's wrong. Shouldn't be that way.
The use of the word Panama here refers to the various scandals which arose in French political circles over the original efforts to construct the Panama Canal. That was from, I believe, 1869 to 1888. If the present form of the protocols had been written at a later date, they might have referred to the Marconi wireless scandals in England, though on second thought, they would not have done so because certain men were involved who were not Gentiles. Herzl, the great Jewish Zionist leader, uses the expression in The Jewish State. speaking of the management of the business of Palestine, he says that the Society of Jews will see to it that the enterprise does not become a Panama but a Suez. The same French engineer that oversaw the construction of the Suez Canal was in charge of the first attempt to build a Panama Canal.
Hmm.
De Lesseps.
Well, the Suez, I guess, was successful and went well, and the Panama didn't because
yeah, the Suez Canal was a big success, and the first attempt to build a Panama Canal was a failure.
Okay, because of scandals. Supposedly there was a lot.
Well,
of
it's largely a failure because of yellow fever and malaria, which were at that point untreatable.
Well, I'll have to look into that. Okay.
They had like 1 in 5 people that were involved with the project died. So they had to pay people very, very highly. And they had various obstacles to overcome, which they hadn't really worked out.
Yeah.
Okay, that the same expression should occur in Herzl and in the protocols is significant. It means that somebody read Herzl, I guess. It has also another significance, which will be described at another time. It must be clear to the reader, however, that no one writing for the general public at this day would refer to a Panama in a man's past. The reference would not be understood. It is this practice of holding a man under obligation which makes it needful on the part of the true publicist to tell the truth and the whole truth about aspirants for public office. It is not enough to say of a candidate that he began as a poor boy and then became successful. How did he become successful? How explains the rise of his fortunes?
Sometimes, how explain?
What?
How explain?
Yeah, how explain the rise of his fortunes? It's a little bit unusual grammatically.
Should say to, how to explain, but it doesn't.
Yeah. Sometimes the clue leads deep into the domestic life of the candidate. It may be told of a man, for example, that he helped another out of a scrape by marrying the woman involved and received a sum of money for doing so. It may be told of another that he was implicated by his too friendly relations with another's wife, but was relieved of his predicament by the astute diplomacy of powerful friends, to whom thereafter he felt himself in debt of honor. It is strange that, in American affairs at least, the woman note is predominant. In our higher offices, that has more frequently occurred than any other, oftener than the money note. In European countries, however, where the fact of a man's being entangled illegitimately with a woman does not carry so heavy a stamp of shame with it, the controlled men have been found to have pasts of another character.
Well, you know, Hadding, we're about out of time here, and we're not going to finish this. And we're coming to, I think, the most important part of this chapter. And we can certainly get into that next week. And in the meantime, we can look into some of these questions that came up previously. I want to look into some of this so that we can really discuss this idea of that's being asked here of whether the protocols explain what has gone on, and if in that case that makes them true, or if they don't, you know. And this is kind of the big question that we have, and some difference between you and I, maybe. So we, you know, I hope we'll spend, there's quite a bit left, we'll spend next week doing that, huh? Okay? He says yes. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Come back next week for the exciting conclusion to this chapter.
Rage, rage, I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.